What is up, you guys? Welcome to another edition of Controversial Thoughts. We are at the end of the first week in January. The first week of the Animal Base 30 is behind us. Hope you guys have all joined us for the Animal Base 30. If not, we are doing a 30-day animal-based reset this January, connected with heart and soil. You can join over 8,000 other people who have begun their adventure with this already at animalbased30.com. There are all sorts of resources there, an infographic that I built on how to do an animal-based diet, videos about how to do an animal-based diet, which are the most toxic and least toxic plants, all things I've done before on Controversial Thoughts, and links to the desiccated organ supplements we make at Heart and Soil if you need more nose-tail nutrition in your life and you cannot get fresh organs. We've got bone marrow and liver back in stock, Heart of the Warrior. We've got gut and digestion back in stock. We've got Immunimilk, which is our grass-fed colostrum. Beef organs and histamine immune will be back soon. We've also got Firestarter, which is on subscribe and save now, and a number of other products in there to help you level up your nutrition with nose-to-tail nutrition, which is the way our ancestors have always eaten. So let's get into today's topic. This is perhaps the most controversial topic that I have ever discussed on Controversial Thoughts, which is saying a lot when I've talked about COVID and many other things. Today, I'm going to talk about the other C word, which is coffee. And it's so controversial. This is amazing to me. Talking about diet becomes religious very quickly. People get insulted. They feel like you're insulting their children or their puppy or something, and you're telling them how to eat. And it's not like that at all, of course. All of you listening to this know that I'm just offering this information for free because it's interesting to me, and I hope that it's helpful to you. And this video podcast is no exception. Don't be emotionally hurt. Don't be offended when I tell you in this video that I'm not a fan of coffee. You are an adult or a young adult, or maybe you're a child listening to this video or podcast. You get to make your own decisions about whether you want to include coffee and tea in your diet. I'm just going to offer you my thoughts, opinions, ideas, musings, connecting of the dots about whether humans should include coffee in their diet if they truly wish to obtain optimal health. The very short and sweet answer is no. I'm not a fan of coffee. I've never been a fan of coffee. I drank coffee for a short amount of time when I was in PA school before I went to medical school. It gave me palpitations. I got a wicked headache when I stopped drinking coffee. I didn't know any of the stuff I'm going to talk about in today's video, but I haven't had a cup of coffee in probably 15 years. I don't drink coffee. I don't think it's good for humans. If I have an anti-coffee bias because I'm not a coffee drinker, then so be it. But I have a number of issues with coffee, and they are these. I have a lot of concerns about acrylamide content in coffee. I'm going to talk about acrylamide. It's a compound formed by what appears to be a Maillard reaction between a sugar molecule and an asparagine, which is an amino acid residue, in the roasting of coffee beans and in the roasting of many other plant products. And there's a lot of good evidence that acrylamide itself is a neurotoxin and a potential carcinogen in both animal and human models. So problem number one, acrylamide. I'm going to go into more detail there. There's a whole set of compounds that are known to antagonize mu opioid receptors, which are the pain receptors. These are the receptors that are, at least some of the receptors that are affected by drugs that are opiates like morphine. So if you antagonize a pain decreasing receptor, it could lead to increased pain syndromes. This is unknown, but there are compounds in coffee that are known to antagonize and block, that is block, mu opioid receptors in the human body. Probably not a good thing for humans. Yet another reason I'm not a fan of coffee. I'm going to go into that in more detail. There's a lot of evidence, research about mycotoxins in coffee, aflatoxin, ochratoxin A, fumonisins. A lot of mycotoxins can happen in coffee and other grains. Caffeine is a type of phytoalexin. It's a plant defense chemical. Caffeine is not good for humans. Caffeine is the reason most of you drink coffee. It's an ergogenic aid, but it certainly has side effects which are clearly negative in humans. And last but not least, I think we cannot ignore the fact that most coffee is pesticide laden. You can get an organic coffee, which is not sprayed with pesticides, which will eliminate that one. But coffee is ultimately made from the seed of a coffee plant, and it is often sprayed with pesticides and will accumulate these. So many reasons to avoid coffee. Let's jump into all of that if you're still with me. So the first and probably the biggest concern I have about coffee is acrylamide, as I said. Acrylamide is a known neurotoxin, a known problematic chemical. You can look at websites, even the FDA will talk about acrylamide. So acrylamide is known to form in foods made from plants, such as potato products, grain products, or coffee. It does not form or forms at much lower levels in dairy, meat, and fish products. There's essentially no acrylamide in animal foods. It's likely to accumulate when cooking is done for longer periods or at higher temperatures. There is data about acrylamide in U.S. foods. I will show you that. Acrylamide is formed in a Maillard reaction between sugars and asparagine in plant-based foods. Again, it is found in many foods that are of the plant nature, including coffee. It is well known to be connected with neurotoxicity as well. And there is a lot of evidence to suggest that it is not good for humans, even to the point that in 2017, there was a court ruling that 7-Eleven and Yum Yum Donuts would post Prop 65 warnings on their coffee because it contained acrylamide. Now, this is a law firm's website showing this, but you can look up this legal decision. This involved Starbucks, Walmart, Costco, 70 other companies who were serving coffee. And the Prop 65 lawsuit said that because it had acrylamide, they needed to say that this was in there and it was a potential carcinogen, a bad thing for humans. So subsequently, on November the 20th, 2020, a federal judge reversed that decision and said you don't have to put warnings on your coffee because it's a known thing that's in there from the consumption of the coffee, from the actual production of the coffee, the acrylamide is formed. Nevertheless, for 3 years, they had to put warnings on their coffee for acrylamide, a Prop 65 warning in California, because it's known to contain a carcinogen and something that is a very clear neurotoxin in animals and looks to be quite culpable as a neurotoxin in humans as well. The only reason they don't have to do it now is because in order to make the coffee edible, they have to roast it. Therefore, the acrylamide is still there. They can't avoid it. So it's a loophole and it got reversed. But Starbucks, 7-Eleven, Yum Yum Donuts, all these companies were part of this lawsuit in 2017. This is real life, stranger than fiction. If you go to the FDA's website, you can download this Excel spreadsheet of acrylamide values in all sorts of food. These are all basically processed foods, cookies, cakes, crackers. You can find coffee on here as well. And you can see that the amounts in coffee are significant and will accumulate when people are eating coffee every single day and multiple cups. The highest amount is this Price First 100% instant coffee, which has 1,080, which is parts per billion acrylamide. There are a number of other foods on this list. All of these are plant foods. Most of them are cookies, cakes, crackers, and chips that have anywhere from undetectable levels of acrylamide to over 1,000 parts per billion of acrylamide. So you can find that list. Coffee does have acrylamide that is not really debatable. So let's look at evidence for acrylamide's guiltiness. So dietary acrylamide in human cancer, a systematic review of the literature, the carcinogenic of dietary potential of dietary acrylamide from cooked foods is unknown. It's a byproduct of the common Maillard reaction where reducing sugars, fructose and glucose react to the amino acids. In this one, they look at this evidence and suggest that a lot more studying is needed because there's a lot of evidence to suggest that this may be a problem. It's classified as a group 2A carcinogen for humans. And if we move on, other studies suggest the same thing. Acrylamide, its metabolism, developmental and reproductive effects, genotoxicity and carcinogenicity. You can find this paper online, read through all the stuff. Probably not a good thing for humans, probably not safe for us, and probably not something we want to be consuming every day chronically. Oh, wait, that's exactly how we consume acrylamide because you're drinking coffee every single day. So if you had any doubts about acrylamide in coffee, there are plenty of studies like this one, which actually assay that, studies of acrylamide level in coffee, coffee substitutes. They found acrylamide in the vast majority of them, with the instant coffees being much higher than the fresh varieties. Two more papers on acrylamide, just to really make this clear. Acrylamide review of toxicity data and dose response analyses for cancer and non-cancer effects. This is a study that said the major findings of these studies indicate that acrylamide is neurotoxic in animals and humans. has been shown to be a reproductive toxicant in animal models and a rodent carcinogen. Several reviews of acrylamide toxicity have been conducted, and acrylamide has been categorized as to its potential to be a human carcinogen in these reviews. So not good there, probably not benign. And then one more study implicating acrylamide as a neurotoxin. So while many researchers believe that exposure to humans to relatively low levels in the diet will not result in clinical neuropathy, some neurotoxicologists are concerned about the potential for its cumulative neurotoxicity. It has been shown in several studies that the same neurotoxic effects can be observed at low and high doses for acrylamide, with the low doses simply requiring longer exposures. So, well, it's a good thing we only drink coffee for a few years of our life. Oh, wait, most of us drink it for 3 to 4 to 5 to 6 decades. Yeah, problematic thing. This is not a good thing. Let's just accept this, guys. I should have said this in the beginning of the video. Coffee's a crutch. If you're drinking coffee, it's because you're tired, you're overworked, you're underslept, and you're using it as a crutch. Coffee has a very small amount of any significant nutrients in it at all. Some people might argue that there's a reasonable amount of riboflavin. I am skeptical of that data, depending on the heat lability of that B vitamin. But no one is drinking coffee because its nutritional value. We eat liver and organs because of the nutritional value. We eat animal foods for the nutritional value. We don't eat coffee for its nutritional value. You drink coffee because you're addicted. I'm sorry, you do. And you need coffee to function in the morning because of a lifetime of use. It's a crutch. It's not a healthy thing for humans. And though people are rebelling and they're angry at this point in the video, if you are emotionally triggered right now, take a deep breath and think about what I said in the beginning. I'm not telling you how to live your life. This gets very religious. I don't think coffee is good for humans. Acrylamide is just the tip of the iceberg. And it's not really adding much to your life. In fact, I would argue that because of caffeine specifically, this methyl xanthine molecule that is used as a phytoalexin, as a plant defense chemical in the coffee plant, probably to ward off the formation of molds, because we know that decaf coffees have more mycotoxins than coffees that are caffeinated. Caffeine is going to inhibit your adenosine receptors. It's going to block them. It's going to be an antagonist, just like the compounds that I'm going to talk about in a moment in coffee that block the mu opioid receptors. But caffeine is going to be a stimulant. It's kind of like many other stimulants or drugs for that matter that I believe are best characterized by the adage, it's borrowing tomorrow's happiness today. You can only keep borrowing tomorrow's happiness today for so long before you run out of tomorrow's. I would encourage you all to do a period of coffee elimination in your diet and see how you feel. This isn't something that is beneficial for humans in general. And acrylamide, just the tip of the iceberg. Let's talk about the mu opioid antagonist molecules in coffee. So again, the opioid signaling system in the body generally deals with pain. Morphine is a mu opioid agonist, meaning that molecule activates mu opioid receptors, not exclusively. There's other types of opioid receptors, kappa, delta, etc. But let's talk about the mu. That's what we think of high level when it comes to pain. If you block mu opioid receptors, it could potentially increase pain. Is it possible that coffee is worsening pain syndromes like chronic pain syndrome, chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, et cetera, complex regional pain syndrome? Yes, the majority of the population drinks coffee. Could this be a problem? Absolutely. And my concern is that it's molecules like this one, this is 4-caffeol-1,5-quinide, found in all coffee. It's a mu opioid receptor antagonist. It's from this paper. Now, let's look at another paper. This same molecule, 4-caffeol-1,5-quinide in roasted coffee, inhibits tritiated naloxone binding and reverses anti-nociceptive effects of morphine in mice. I almost said in rice, but it's in mice. Trust me, they're not doing experiments in rice. Tritium is 3-hydrogen, so it's a different molecule of hydrogen that we can use to label molecules like naloxone, which is a molecule, which is a pharmaceutical that we use in medicine to bind to the mu opioid receptor. So if this molecule inhibits naloxone binding and reverses the anti-nociceptive, which means the anti-pain effects of morphine in mice, then we have a molecule that is blocking the mu opioid receptor effectively. So you can see this study, these results suggest the previously reported anti-opioid activity of instant coffee is caused primarily by the presence of 4-CQL, the molecule I just showed you, to a lesser extent by other cinnamoyl 1,5-quinides. Complex molecules, you guys get the idea. Coffee contains potent opiate receptor binding activity. Another paper from Nature from 1983 showing the same thing. Coffee has molecules in it that are binding to your opioid receptors and probably blocking them, probably creating worse pain. I'll let you decide if that's a good thing. One more. Beyond caffeine, coffee contains opiate antagonists. This one's from 2014. You can read the paper here. They're looking at the same compounds and suggesting the same problems. So if anyone is listening to this and has issues with fibromyalgia, complex regional pain, chronic fatigue syndrome, and you're drinking coffee, I'll ask you gently, why? Why are you drinking coffee? This is why coffee is not something that I would recommend on an animal-based diet, guys. And we haven't even gotten to mycotoxins or caffeine yet. Let's talk about those briefly now. Caffeine, as I said, is a methylxanthine. It's going to block a wide range of adenosine receptors and phosphodiesterase. The mechanism isn't terribly important other than to say that adenosine signals sleepiness in humans. And if you block that, that's probably why we have a stimulant effect to caffeine in the human body. Caffeine does have antifungal properties. That's probably one of the reasons, potentially one of the reasons, that coffee plants produce caffeine. As you'll see in the next section, there is more mold that grows on decaffeinated coffee. There are more mycotoxins in decaffeinated coffee beans. Caffeine is toxic at high doses. It does have a LD50, a lethal dose 50. It clearly causes palpitations, tachycardia, worsening anxiety, insomnia, all kinds of problems with sleep. It's not a good thing if you haven't slept and you need it as a crutch, like they do to us all in residency, in medical school. You may use it temporarily, but it's not a good thing. It's not healthy for you. It is borrowing tomorrow's happiness today. I will happily, proudly say that I got through residency, medical school, PA school, no coffee, except one small incidence in PA school that I mentioned earlier, which probably gave me some kind of palpitations, premature atrial contractions, perhaps. Anyway, let's look at these studies. Blood pressure response to caffeine shows incomplete tolerance after short-term regular consumption. Basically, this is showing that daily caffeine consumption failed to eliminate the blood pressure response, and repeated challenge doses of caffeine in half the healthy adults who were tested resulted in persistent elevated blood pressure. So one of the criticisms of caffeine has been that it will raise blood pressure, probably not a good thing. And the response has been, well, that eventually is ameliorated with time, that eventually is lessened with time. And there are studies like this one, which suggests that that is not the case, that long-term consumption of coffee does not lead to normalization of blood pressure. And in half the individuals, at least in this study, long-term consumption of coffee led to persistent elevation of blood pressure. If you need more information or more evidence that coffee is problematic, caffeine increases the rate of bone loss in elderly women, interacts with the vitamin D receptor genotypes. I think about this one with my mom. She's 70 years old, has struggled with osteopenia and osteoporosis her whole life, has had coffee her whole life, and probably has some degree of actual pain syndromes herself. Intakes of caffeine in amounts greater than 300 milligrams per day, or 18 ounces of brewed coffee, accelerated bone loss in the spine in elderly postmenopausal women. Women with the TT genetic variant of the VDR, that is the vitamin D receptor gene, appear to be at greater risk for the deleterious effect of caffeine on bone. This is a 2001 paper in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. You could look at your genotype for the VDR gene in something like 23andMe or other genetic analyses, but 300 milligrams of caffeine a day is not unreachable for most people. 18 ounces of brewed coffee is just a few cups of coffee per day, depending on how big your mug slash flask is. So this is not a benign substance, you guys, not at all. I won't even go into the anxiety or other issues because they are so evident. Take your blood pressure, check your pulse, and after you drink some caffeine, and you will quickly see that caffeine has many negative effects on your vasculature in terms of blood pressure, pulse rate, bone loss, etc. At least the checking your blood pressure and pulse will show you the cardiovascular effects acutely, quite clearly. Let's talk about the mold toxins in coffee. Basically, There may be ways to mitigate this based on the processing of coffee, but Aspergillus is a mold. There are other molds that make things like ochratoxin, fumonisins. Aspergillus is going to make something called aflatoxin. There are multiple types of this. There are many surveys of aflatoxin in food. Aflatoxin is a pretty clear known carcinogen for humans. And though people may respond that the processing, the roasting of the coffee eliminates most of the aflatoxin or other mold toxins, it's probably the cumulative effect of these in humans that leads to problems long-term. Humans get cancer. We don't fully understand what causes this. One of the real possibilities is the accumulation, the chronic total dose of aflatoxin, ochratoxin, fumonisins, mold toxins in general, or other environmental toxins that we're talking about. Things like perchlorates, if you listen to my video with Frank von Hippel, acrylamide, all these things combined together. And if you are told by health authorities that a small amount here and a small amount there isn't a big deal, are you really able to make a judgment based on the cumulative effect of everything you are eating? If you are getting acrylamide and ochratoxin and fumonisins, this is the point of really considering every piece of your diet. And in my mind, eliminating as many potential carcinogens as possible while still living a life that you enjoy. That's always the balance. If you've read my book, The Carnivore Code, you'll know that it's all about a quality of life equation. But in general, animal foods are free of so many of these things. Animal foods don't have mold toxins. If they're fresh and cooked properly, they don't have acrylamide. They don't have any of these things. If you base your diet around these or fresh, non-toxic plant foods, like I talk about in other videos, like you can get at Animal Based 30, animalbased30.com, there's plenty of resources there. I think you'll be better off if you eliminate or lessen, minimize the total amount of mold, acrylamide, mycotoxins, et cetera, in your diet. Not a good thing to have. So let's talk about acrylamide. Let's talk about aflatoxin. Let's talk about mycotoxins. There are lots of these in coffee. So mycotoxins in coffee, this is a survey from 1980. And these people concluded that there was a low frequency of findings, low level of toxins, and experimental data showing 70 to 80% by the roasting of toxins added to green coffee. So they discontinued study on the topic. But there's a lot of other things that could be problematic here. This is a overall review on mycotoxins from 2003 that focuses on them in a variety of foods and looks at aflatoxin and other mold toxins, fumonisins, ochratoxin A. There are tons, zearalenone. Many of these do occur on grains and beer and coffee. It's not really debatable. Here's a survey from 2004 to 2007 in Japan. These researchers did not stop looking. And they found that there were very high amounts of ochratoxin in oatmeal, rye, raisins, or I should say there were significant amounts in oatmeal, rye, raisins, wine, and roasted coffee beans. And they varied remarkably from year to year. Fumonisins detected in frozen and canned corn, popcorn grits, corn flakes, corn syrups, corn snacks, beer, soybeans, millet, and asparagus. Highest concentration was in corn grits. If you need any more reason to not eat these garbage foods, there you go. Bonus on the coffee podcast. All samples of corn grits were contaminated with fumonisins. People always ask me, what about oats? What about this grain? What about that grain? They're going to have mycotoxins, you guys. They're going to have mycotoxins more often than not. So you can see that's an interesting study in Japan. Here's one, the occurrence of ochratoxin A in coffee. It is from Aspergillus and Penicillium. It's found in foodstuffs, predominantly cereals and coffee beans. They found it in many samples to a variety of degrees. So incidence level behavior of aflatoxins during coffee bean roasting and decaffeination. Yet another one, aflatoxins were detected in 76.5 and 54.6 of the infected samples with averages of these levels in them. Highest yields of aflatoxins were detected in the decaffeinated green coffee beans and roasted coffee beans. The growth of Aspergillus flavus in liquid medium containing 1 or 2% caffeine was reduced by 50%. As I mentioned, caffeine is probably somewhat of it's definitely a phytoalexin. It's meant to be a plant defense chemical, but it will decrease the mold growth in general. Aflatoxin and ochratoxin A contamination of retail foods, intake of these mycotoxins in Japan. Another study showing the same things. Aflatoxins and ochratoxin A intakes through the consumption of foods containing cacao and others. They were found in 120 out of 192 samples of oatmeal, wheat flour, rye, buckwheat flour, raw coffee, roasted coffee, raisins, beer, wine, and bitter chocolate. So beer, wine, bitter chocolate. Do you need another reason? Here we go. I know I'm going to get the question. What about chocolate? Not a fan. For this and other reasons, I would decrease your overall consumption of these if you want to be as healthy as possible. That's just how it goes. All right, a couple more here, you guys. Incidence level, behavior of aflatoxins during coffee bean roasting and decaffeination. I think I showed this one previously, 56, 54.6%. There was some reduction with roasting, but there's still some there, and it's all about the cumulative amounts. And then if you had any doubts about this, well, I should say, let's talk about this last point on these. There's really no doubt that there are mold toxins in coffee. Some coffees advertise they have less, which is probably a good thing, but even those coffees are going to have problems with caffeine, or they're going to have problems with mold toxins if they're decaffeinated, likely. They may have pesticides. They may be organic, which would mitigate some of the pesticides. They're all going to have acrylamide, and they're all going to have other issues. So I want to show you guys one paper, which is epidemiology. This is observational, so we can't draw any conclusions, but it's a meta-analysis looking at the consumption of coffee and the risk of gastric cancer. So it found that there was overall an association between coffee consumption and gastric cancer. Now, all the studies are listed here. You can see the forest plot here. There's a couple of studies that are quite significant, but the overall effect size looks like the consumption of coffee was associated with gastric cancer. This is the risk of gastric cancer associated with 3 cups of coffee per day. Still, there is an association, though it's less strong. Forest plots are looking at all of the data together. So again, it's observational. We can't say for sure. And I want to point out that there is certainly a lot of evidence that many would try to point to suggesting that coffee is beneficial, because you guys are listening to this video and saying, but Paul, I hear from everyone, my neighbor, my grandma, this health pundit, that health pundit, that coffee is so good for me. How can this be? The vast majority of the studies cited by those people, if they're even citing studies, are epidemiology. They're observational. And we just can't draw a causative inference there to say that coffee is helpful for humans. There are some interventional studies that suggest that the consumption of coffee will increase glutathione, but there are compounds in coffee, polyphenolic compounds, that are known to activate NRF2. I've talked about this at length in the past. This is a enzymatic system, a transcription factor in the liver that then turns on genes involved in the production of glutathione, which is a master antioxidant in the human body, an endogenous antioxidant. There are lots of things that turn on NRF2. So sulforaphane, many other things. Tobacco smoke will do it. Lead will do it. Mercury will do it. Alcohol will do it. Oxidative stressors will turn on NRF2. In fact, cold exposure will also do it. Heat exposure probably does it too. And exercise does it as well. This goes back to the concept of molecular versus environmental hormesis, which is a complex concept that I've explained multiple times, but the short and sweet, or I should say the distilled version, is perhaps that environmental hormetics are things like ketosis, fasting, sunlight, exercise, heat stress, cold stress. These can create oxidative stress in the human body and turn on NRF2. But they don't have collateral effects because they generally don't involve an exogenous and outside of the body's molecule. Ketones are produced endogenously, beta-hydroxybutyrate, acetoacetate, et cetera. But exogenous molecules, sulforaphane, the polyphenols in coffee, caffeic acid, which is different than caffeine, chlorogenic acid, isothiocyanates, these turn on the production of NRF2 by creating oxidative stress in the human body. They are not antioxidants, they are prooxidants. Now, if that was all they did, you could make an argument for hormesis there, but I don't think that hormesis is worth it because it's redundant. You can get the benefit by doing the other things that I mentioned that are environmental hormetics. And the problem with these molecules, whether it's caffeic acid, chlorogenic acid, sulforaphane, you name the plant molecule, we can go down this discussion, is that they have collaterally damaging side effects. I've spoken at length about the potential downsides of sulforaphane, which is the magical quote molecule in broccoli sprouts that can that is part of a family of isothiocyanates, which are known to inhibit iodine uptake at the level of the thyroid and have other negative effects in the human body. In the case of coffee, there is some concern that these caffeic acids and chlorogenic acids and other molecules could have negative effects in the human body. I showed you guys the effects of one of those molecules when I was talking about the anti-opioid or anti-opiate effects of this molecule at the level of the mu opioid receptor. When you go to the pharmacy and you buy a medication or you get a prescription medication, it has a package insert with side effects. Plant molecules have that. Really, all exogenous molecules have that. Pharmaceuticals we use in medicine have that. But we've forgotten about those in medicine. We've forgotten about that with plant molecules. And if you want to use a plant molecule as a food or believe that a plant molecule is uniquely beneficial for you, you need to remember that the benefits must outweigh the risks. And my opinion, my belief is that they do not with plant molecules, because the benefits are largely redundant. You can stress your oxidative stress system. You can get more NRF2 moving to the nucleus and transcribing or causing the transcription of all the genes involved in the formation of glutathione without plant molecules, okay? And then you won't have side effects. Or you can use sulforaphane and you can potentially have bad side effects with many of the other hormonal systems in your body, thyroid, et cetera. And it goes on and on depending on the molecule that we're talking about, whether it's resveratrol. I spoke about that one last week in the wine discussion. Not a fan of that one either. Can inhibit the formation of androgen precursors like DHEA. It is a xenoestrogen that mimics estrogen in the human body. Not a valuable thing. You don't need that. You can activate sirtuin genes by fasting, by being in ketosis. These are redundant effects with negative side effects leading to a net negative effect in humans. Hopefully that all makes sense. But generally, if we look at the interventional studies with coffee, you can show that there are molecules in coffee that will trigger NRF2. But at what cost? At what cost? They may also break DNA. They may also inhibit the natural progression of signaling in the body with regard to mu opioid receptors, et cetera. So that's my concern. Bad side effects, redundant benefits with regard to these molecules. And the majority of research with coffee is epidemiology. And we just can't say that that's conclusive. We cannot draw causative inference. In my mind, it's quite possible that those who drink more coffee are of a higher socioeconomic status or have other health behaviors that could be confounding this issue. So in summary, I'm not a fan of coffee. I still love you all, even if you choose to keep drinking coffee. It's your personal choice. I think you'll be better off without it for so many reasons. Acrylamide, which is potentially problematic from a neurotoxin perspective, potential carcinogen, et cetera. All of these opioid inhibiting compounds in humans, these mu opiate antagonists, caffeine, not a great thing for humans. For so many reasons, it's also diuretic, causing mineral loss, affecting mineral balance, sleep, insomnia, et cetera. Potential mycotoxins, which accumulate and with other toxins to potentially have a carcinogenic effect in humans, and all the potential bad side effects with other molecules that I didn't even talk about in this video, not to mention coffee breath, stained teeth, and why are you drinking it in the first place? So my advice would be to wean off of it. You'll feel better without it. If you must include it in your diet, I think it's probably the third or fourth or fifth thing to do. I would start on your animal-based diet by eliminating seed oils, then eliminating the most toxic plants, always getting nose to tail animal foods, animal meat, and organs. If you can't get organs, that's why we do what we do at Heart and Soil. Check us out at heartandsoil.co for more desiccated organ supplements. Tea is largely the same story. I probably should do a whole separate video on tea, but I'm not a fan of tea either. So here is your brief summary on tea. It's plant leaves with caffeine and other molecules that are probably not great for humans in general. If you want to drink it, it's your choice. But my belief is that it's not a positive thing for humans' health, and I would avoid it on this diet is my recommendation. But ultimately, you should do what you feel is best. Simple steps will make big improvements in your diet, in your lifestyle, in your overall health. And I think that these are the fourth and fifth steps down the road. They're not the first step. I wouldn't eliminate coffee first. I would think about getting rid of excess alcohol before that, definitely getting rid of seed oils, eliminating the most toxic plants, and making the majority of your diet animal meat and organs. So hopefully that helps. That's a bomb, you guys. That's a very controversial video. Thanks for being a part of the remembering. Stay radical.